dying, Father, is nothing less.
Ever since I was a child, I have a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Let God and the devil don't mess with you. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb. And you must learn what it means to become responsible. This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
Welcome to everyone. This is Henrik. I hope you know that you're listening to Red Ice Radio, wherever you are, or whenever you're listening to this broadcast. We do appreciate your attention. RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com is our website where you will find much more. Patrick Henningsen from 21stCenturyWire.com is with us today to talk about the recent Boston bombings and the bigger geopolitical picture. A lot to come, and we're going to dive right into this one, so stay with us. All right. Hi, Patrick. Good of you to join us today. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. It's excellent to have you with us. How are you today?
Yes, very good. Thank you, Henrik. It's great to be on your show. I've been a big fan of your site for quite a long time, and your radio shows are some of the best out there. Your podcasts that I used to listen to years ago, some of the best stuff out there, yeah.
Thank you, Patrick. We really appreciate that. And some of our listeners might have seen you, pop up on RT. They might be familiar with your website, 21stCenturyWire.com. Maybe we can just briefly kind of get into when and of course why you wanted to start the website and offer an alternative analysis and perspective, Patrick.
Well, that's a good question, and also an interesting story. The thing that got me involved in the alternative media as a consumer, as a reader, was September 11th, 2001. And at that time, I was living in London, and I saw 9/11 from a distance. It was a safe enough distance that I wasn't under the cloak of American patriotism and all the sort of pressures that it probably would have been to bear had I been in the United States. But luckily, I was in London. And at the same time, I was also witnessing the Second Intifada between Palestine and Israel. So these two things together, and then the Iraq War came in 2003, and by that time, by 2004, I was more or less hooked 24/7 on alternative media, PrisonPlanet.com, and other sites, related sites, even DavidIke.com, those great headlines, daily headlines, and on many other websites. And yeah, and then basically I was living a double life at that point, which was investigating, learning, talking to people, going to conferences, holding down a corporate job. And at some point in 2007, I realized that it's going to be really hard to do this, lead a double life. So I basically quit my job pursued this as a full-time endeavor. I started writing for other websites and eventually decided to start my own website so I didn't have to go through any editorial filters. And I started a very simple blog. I did it with free software, WordPress.com, and registered my domain. And I did this at the same time the UN Climate Conference was going on in Copenhagen, Denmark, 2009,
yeah.
Winter, December. And I was over there and I dropped an email to Infowars.com And I said, hey, I'm over here. I've come here on my own dime. I've got a cameraman with me. Do you guys want any reports? And they said, yeah. So I did some reporting that week for InfoWars, and that really helped jumpstart my blog. But of course, after that event was over, I was really back to sort of day-to-day analyzing, reading, writing. And I wrote a few articles on this blog. And this is significant because a lot of people are out there thinking, wow, you know, how can I get involved? How can I do something? And all I did was I really wrote a couple of articles mainly on what was going on in Libya. This is before Gaddafi was overthrown. And Russia Today, for some reason, someone in their news desk saw one of these articles. They called me and they said, do you want to come on our program, talk about your article? And that was in 2010, in April. And I've been on Russia Today over, I don't know, let's say almost 100 appearances since then. And that's really helped give me a platform to give my opinion on geopolitical events. And it's also helped very much sharpen up my presentation skills. And I've upgraded 21st Century Wire with the help of friends and volunteers. We haven't had any money. and built it up to where it is now. And, you know, I think we're in the sort of top, this week we're in the top 10,000 websites in the United States. And when I started, we were 1.5 million in the back of the queue. So, you know, and this is all done with no money, Henrik. I've had to do work and prostitute myself as a contractor to keep the bills paid. But, you know, I don't regret the move I made in 2007 at all. I think it's been a great move. And one day, you know, very soon probably, 21st Century Wire will be able to pay for itself and be able to, you know, make a wage and really focus full-time on what we're doing here.
Well, exactly. I mean, ultimately, that's got to be one of the best things you can do, just get out of the whole corporate environment, start your own and do it your own way. And that's why it's so important, of course, for people to support journalists like yourself and other people who are doing the best they can to, you know, offer an alternative perspective, offer something tangible to, you know, the journalist field that we do have, which is a sad state of affairs, you know, today. So I think that's excellent that you've been able to do that. Now, did you have any prior, like, journalist education, or you just got a knack for writing pretty much?
No, actually, I wouldn't say I was a very good writer. The last thing I probably wrote was my graduation exam at University of California in 1993. And I really had to teach myself to write. I got on a website called helium.com, which was a blogger's site for beginners, and people would vote as to which story was the best on any particular topic. So you'd have 20 people on each side. And I started winning all these rankings. And so I thought, I wasn't confident at all, Henrik, when I started. I thought my writing skills, I used to read The Independent, The Guardian, The Washington Post, a lot of the top newspapers, and I'd read some of these people's writings. I was wondering if I could ever achieve anything near that skill, the brilliant skill, storytelling, analyzing, and then sort of dumping in the theme as well to tie it all together. And it just came out of a lot of practice. I probably wrote over 100 articles on Helium, and also Op-Ed News was a reader-driven, people-driven content site. It's still up and still very good. But those websites was my training ground for me writing for myself without, you know, any cues or any assignments or anything like that. So I think it's something that, you know, I needed to learn. So I've also taken jobs and contracts in the corporate and marketing sphere that required writing, copywriting, and that helps just your writing skills. So it's like anything. If you're a mechanic, you're an engineer, you need to practice. If you're a writer, you're an artist, you're a music producer, the more work you do, it doesn't matter as well what content you're working on, that it's more important that you're working. and you keep working and waiting for your opportunities to come available to write about the things that you want to write about. And that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, that's right. You got to keep at it and training and everything. I'm personally horrible at writing. I mean, it's my second language as well, but I just nothing for me. And that's the reason, of course, I'm doing talk radio at this stage. So I'm always impressed by people who can just, pick up a pen pretty much or a keyboard and start going at it. So that's great stuff, Patrick.
The written word, I really enjoy radio, by the way. And I do a regular slot on a major U.S. radio show Monday to Friday, just reading the news headlines. But the thing about the written word, the print word, is there's a certain permanence about it. And as soon as you sign off your name, as soon as you hit update, and that thing goes live, basically you can't erase it, you can't pull it down. And it can be quite a daunting thing to put your own words up there. And I struggled with that at the beginning. I really struggled with that. I used to freak out after I'd write and publish something, thinking, oh my God, my life's going to change because I just said this about this politician or this president or this piece of legislation.
Yeah.
And freaking out, staying up all night, couldn't sleep, And soon you just get over it. And after speaking to some of the old hacks, I mean, I'm right now this month in Beirut, in Lebanon, and speaking to some of the old hacks here, that have been correspondents here for 40 plus years, and they're in their sort of 70s and 80s right now. They've written about 10 books apiece, and I don't know how many thousands of articles. And you can just tell after speaking to some of these people, at some point, I don't know if this is a family show or not, but at some point, they just don't give a damn. You just basically publish and be damned, as they say,
yeah.
in the old days. And I've got a lot of respect for a lot of the old school journalists who lived before the complete corporatization of our mainstream media, which is kind of taking place right now, mainly in Europe and in North America and also in other parts of the world, of course. But it's really, really a chronic problem in Western culture. So I really respect some of the old hacks because there's the dinosaurs that are still around to tell us some of the stories, the real war stories.
Well, exactly. Good point. Maybe a little bit later, Patrick, we can get into that a little bit more, talk about journalism, how it's changed and kind of the media landscape today as well. But our main focus, I guess, today is of course, the Boston bombings. And I know that you guys have done some great coverage on that, so I'm excited to get into that and talk more about that. But I just wanted to ask as well, as you said, you're in Beirut right now. And so our listeners can know as well that the connection is not the best currently with Patrick. It's kind of going up and down a little bit, but we're doing the best we can here to keep it open and clear. But so what are you doing in Beirut right now, Patrick? If we just talk about that briefly first.
Yeah, I came here originally to get closer to the Syrian conflict and also to be able to write and also meet people and network with other correspondents and journalists here who are freelance or independent. Some are actually writing for major newspapers, and also to get sort of stories, or first-hand stories of refugees and migrant workers from Syria, because a lot of what we hear, obviously, is dependent on the sources that are feeding the mainstream press. So to get the variation of opinion or analysis is really difficult. So one has to, at some point, go and go there themselves to find out for themselves. And being here also has allowed me to spend time in Cyprus, which is only 45 minutes away by airplane, to investigate and to cover, which we did in quite some depth, the Cyprus banking collapse, which was happened recently in Cyprus. So, again, we're going in villages, talking to people, first-hand accounts, getting the real feeling from the ground, and then constructing our story from there rather than the way that the mainstream media does it. But also I'm working on a book here as well, which I'm about a quarter of the way through, and also a few films that were film projects that I started around Christmas. And hopefully we're going to finish some of them before the summer.
Very good. Yeah, you're a busy man. I might want to hear more about that later and see how it's going to be presented at the end. But let's get to the Boston bombings and kind of set the stage a little bit for that. We'll obviously want to get your assessment of the situation and what actually happened. And maybe we can just also bring some people up to speed, Patrick, that might not have followed the story from the beginning. So what happened? What has occurred?
Well, everyone knows what happened. On the surface, anyway, two bombs went off at the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Having grown up in Boston myself, this area and the scene is very familiar to me. And when I saw it, straight away, I looked at this event and I said to myself, having known what I know about 7/7 in London, having known what I know about Operation Gladio, about Anders Breivik, about September 11th, immediately, I assumed that it was some sort of a staged false flag event, possibly a drill that went live on the day. This is without seeing any evidence or any of the photographic evidence that came out before. And I wasn't alone by any stretch of the imagination. I think a lot of people had the same thought in their head.
Yeah.
And that's the big difference between 9/11 and Boston, is that here we are in 2013 and a lot of people haven't been able to study the evidence. By having access to a free internet has allowed them to at least approach it with a skeptical mind. Now, what we found out very quickly was that there was many characters and people on the scene of that bombing, and some of these people are quite conspicuous. Kraft International, mercenary firm, which is based out of Dallas, Texas, there's people there in identical gear wearing Kraft apparel. Now, they could be wearing Kraft apparel, and they could be somebody else. It was just one example. And a lot of other people wearing sunglasses, especially emergency first responders and EMS people. And Boston Marathon is notorious for being rainy and overcast. And that's something I was very suspicious about. But just beyond that, the actual appearance of mercenaries with comms units in their ears at the very locations where the bombs went off, and all these pictures, which basically came out online. What happened was the law enforcement, I believe before the federal investigators took over the scene, FBI took over the whole operation, the law enforcement had made a public solicitation for any photographs or any video to please put it up online. And there's a website called 4chan, which is 4chan.com, which is a crowdsourcing website. And what typically is on 4chan is people after they go to a party or have a weekend or a barbecue or a fraternity party, they'll put all their stuff up on 4chan. Now, there's also a lot of pornography as well on 4chan, so this has an adult aspect to it. But a lot of people poured a lot of data in terms of photographs and videos and GIFs onto 4chan. That was then sifted through by the public. And at this very time, then the federal government took over the investigation and basically announced on Wednesday, do not look at any other photographs online. Here are your two suspects. And they gave two pictures of two brothers, the Tizaneev brothers, one older and one younger. And they said, these are our prime suspects. And ignore everything else. And, of course, by this time, the cat's already out of the bag. People have already gone and digested and seen and analyzed. And there's some incredible just basic analytical work that the alternative media did. And also just members of the public. Because you have to remember, people were watching broadcasts. People were more or less glued to the televisions, not only in Boston but nationwide, watching all channels. So we put a tip line out on our website, and we got 4,000 tips within 2 hours, and it crashed the service. So they shut it down, and we've had drips and drabs come in, and some of the stuff that's coming in is absolutely brilliant. And people have pointed out all kinds of things, anomalies, things that they've seen. And one of the things that we found very early on, I would say back on Thursday of last week, we found a video of a man being handcuffed, marched, escorted naked, and put into a police car. And this person looked very much like the Tamerlan Cesarinov, who was the older suspect, who the police claimed on Thursday night, I believe, was shot dead and ran over by his brother. And of course, they released photographs from the morgue as a post-mortem to show that he's mangled, had been run over, and so forth. And we have this video of, arguably, we put up, and we asked the public, we said, is this Tamerlan? Can anybody give us any information? And that was seen by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people already, if not more. And a lot of the stuff that came back, and it turns out that although people said that, and original reports from local news had said that that was him. So how could he have been killed and run over by his brother if the police had him in custody in perfect health?
Yeah.
So you put that together with the fact that if the FBI had been interfacing with this individual for up to 5 years before the event, now you take that and you put it into the real situation whereby all the terrorist events in the United States since 9/11 have all been, including 9/11 actually, have all included or featured FBI informants in the terrorist groups. So in other words, the FBI will actively recruit terrorists into cells. They will keep them, groom them, train them, send them off to do a bombing, and then right before the bombing they will arrest them and announce that they've made a terror arrest. This is common practice. And this has happened with, I believe, not the Times Square bombing, but another bombing in New York with the Bengali student just last year.
Yeah.
And the first World Trade Center bombing, which was in 1993, which a lot of people forgot about and are unaware of,
yeah,
there was a major car bomb inserted below the World Trade Center in 2003. In 1993. This is long before 9/11. And the FBI had put the group together, trained the driver, helped them assemble the bombs, provided the detonators, and that drill was supposed to basically be thwarted at the last minute. And the FBI, someone high up in the chain, said, let them go for it.
Yeah.
And they detonated the bomb. And they still announced, it's amazing that even though this is proven through history, they still announced that it was a terror attack. So we have this theme of people being handled by the FBI. We have this in Oklahoma City in 1995. And again, at that crime scene, the federal investigators took over the scene and everything changed after that. The suspects changed, the narrative changed, everything changed. We saw the same thing happen in Boston last week. And I specifically made a point to publish articles showing the history of Oklahoma City and comparing it to what's going on in Boston. We were literally doing real-time investigations on the air with seven or eight people on the line on the Pete Santilli show, which is run out of Los Angeles. And we had people crowdsourcing information live in real time. And other bloggers like Alexander Higgins, who's an incredible blogger, who lives on the East Coast in America, amazing, amazing guy, very resourceful, very fast, and other investigators. We were calling up the families of the suspects live on the air to get, because there were two suspects that came out before the FBI announced their official names, and these were two different names, and we outlined that. It was Sunil Tripathi and Mike Mulugeta, and we have that broken down on 21st Century Wire, and all of a sudden, the Boston police their names were appearing on the scanner. They were in pursuit of these individuals. And all of a sudden, the names changed to the Tsarnaev brothers. Okay? And we fleshed that out overnight. So basically, they fired up the radio show at midnight on Thursday and read straight through to 7 a.m. live on the live stream. And I have to say that was a great effort by those guys. And we phoned up the FBI live on the air. We said, what about these two names that you had before, the Boston police had? What about them? Do you have any comment? Of course, they were upset that we were bringing this up and we're doing it live on the air. You know, it's a very risky business, but I have to say that, you know, the reason the alternative media is so adamant about picking apart these events is because the bottom line, Henrik, people do not trust the government or the mainstream corporate media. And if they did, then this wouldn't be such, that people would not be so adamant about checking and analyzing things, because people believe they've been lied to. And you can't get around that fact, no matter how many whitewashes, no matter how many, you know, times you try to knock that premise down, you cannot get around it. You cannot tell me, having known what I know and what most people who've watched 7-7 Ripple Effect know, that London 7-7 was a completely staged event. Mm-hmm. You know, knowing that, and knowing the details of it, knowing how it was done, knowing the schedule, where the anomalies are, where they covered this up, where the bombers got shot trying to go to the newspapers in Canary Wharf on the day. Knowing this, how can you look at an event like Boston and just sit there and wait for the official explanation? You know, that it's going to be a domestic terrorist or an Al-Qaeda cell, or, you know, we've just been fed this stuff for years and years, and a lot of people still buy it. Okay, most people, probably the majority, do buy the official explanations, but there's a lot of people in the alternative sphere who are proactive consumers of media. In other words, they're not passive. They don't sit back and let it be fed to them. They go out looking for it. That's the difference between the alternative media, the internet media, and the mainstream media.
Indeed, Patrick. Very good. Now, we have the scenario of Big Brother, and I remember a few years ago when the concept of Little Brother came into the picture, which is an interesting kind of turn of events. Basically, the point of argument here is that there's so many cameras on the ground right now. People are taking photos. They have videos on their cell phone. Combine that with security cameras and everything else, and if they are uploaded to the web, then it becomes, you know, increasingly easy for people who really want to look into it to try to find out. And this is what happened with some of the people that you mentioned here, obviously, that were kind of dressed up in this particular garb, these kind of mercenaries, the craft, outfits that they had on and all that. Do you know, Patrick, if any of the photos or such that were uploaded to 4chan that you mentioned earlier, were any of this from, let's say, security cameras? They've been hacked in any way, or was this regular people's photos and stuff like that? Do you know?
Well, this is the danger, obviously, of what you're talking about. What you're describing here is actually a very good point. It's the concept of the panopticon, which was a concept which was invented by an 18th century philosopher named Jeremy Bentham in the United Kingdom. He had this idea, this concept of a prison, whereby the inmates were being watched all the time, but they didn't know they were being watched. And of course, the digital and social media has taken this to another level, whereby, you know, we are also, we're not only being surveilled by the state, but we're also surveilling each other.
Yeah.
And then there's the added problem, which you mentioned, of people dropping in what's called limited hangouts, or assaulting real data or real intelligence, real photographs with doctored ones or faked ones. And so you could have red herrings sprinkled in this mix because it's open source. Okay, now the people who are going to say that, be critical of the open source of the alternative media because of that, I have to say that it's not really an argument, because the state can do the exact same thing behind without any analysis or any timestamps, or which is what they did in 7-7. They actually changed the timestamps or removed the timestamps from security cameras to make it look like all the bombers were going together to Luton Station the morning of 7-7. And that was easily done behind closed doors by the companies who operate the security cameras, or who have access to those, or back doors, or whatnot. So, yes, this is a danger, and really there's no way you can get around that. What you can do is you have to have a really sharp eye, and people need to be well primed when they're investigating. And I think I've seen a lot of great, very diligent looking at the order, the time frames, frame by frame. I've seen analysis is done. Alexander Higgins did a brilliant job. Basically, the FBI released a video of the two brothers, the Tizarnev brothers, which was supposed to be a security camera feed. Well, it turns out they basically took still photographs and put them in an animated timeline and released it as video. And by doing this, they've also managed to conceal some of the markings and some of the important details on some of the people in the area where these people were walking, so to hide something. And that, to me, was very revealing. Of course, we published an article on 21st Century Wire about the FBI, faking surveillance video. And it got thousands and thousands and thousands of hits. And Alexander Higgins did that for beforeitsnews.com, which is a great crowdsourcing news site. And it's a great analysis. And only you have to have a certain kind of mind to be able to break some of this down. It's not the mind of a conspiracy theorist. It's the mind of a skeptic first. And also, some people are just very talented in their ability to break things down and analyze them very quickly. You take 10 people, and 9 of them won't be able to do it, and 1 of them will be able to do it 100 times faster than the other 9. That's just a fact. Not everybody has the same abilities. I certainly couldn't do it, but he did it, and other people have done similar work. So that is the kind of amazing thing about Boston, is that we've seen a lot of these things come to the fore, and also it's helped to really provide some of the really important questions to challenge the official narrative. And the official narrative, even by mainstream pundits, is seen to be severely lacking. So the alternative media has just come in like a battering ram, really, and just smashed this facade of an official federal investigation. In other words, nothing to see here, move along. They've just smashed this to pieces. Very quickly and in real time, and that's unprecedented. And I think the establishment is really frightened about what happened, because they had, I believe, my opinion is, they had a Anglo-Saxon right-wing patriot pro-Second Amendment gun-toting patsy in the wings, ready to be presented as the culprit. And they had to go with Plan B, which was the sort of homegrown Islamic terrorists.
Okay, let's back up there, because I wanted to ask you about this. So just make the comparison, basically, what the official story is at this point of what happened, and then give us your take on what you believe really has happened, and detail this a little bit more, what you just said, Patrick, if you don't mind.
Well, with any sort of staged operation, if you look at any kind of what we call counterintelligence or counterterrorism, if you study some of the documents and declassified bits of information that we can look at in history, there's always the backup plans, and then there's backup plans. So in other words, if you're running an operation, you have the first wave, second wave, and the third wave. If the first wave is unsuccessful, then you implement. You put the second set of assets into play, and then the third set is also waiting as a contingency, maybe fourth and a fifth set, who knows. So I believe, and also just by the evidence, looking at, we saw these names that were circulated and on Boston police scanners live in newspapers, and then we saw a second set of names to replace those by the federal investigation body who took over the Boston bombings, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security. So that indicated to me that this kind of was already in play. Now, a lot of people came out straight away, and the mainstream media, MSNBC, Fox, everybody was saying right-wing, white, domestic, pro-gun patriot, straight away from the word go. And that seemed to be like the paradigm that was coming. And then all those photographs came out on 4chan within 24 hours.
This was just regular people that was at Boston at that time and taking all the photos. And did they upload, or did someone on 4chan collect all these photos to bring them to one source? Do you know?
They uploaded. They just dumped it. And then some people went and combed through the dumps and made and ordered them and took away the relevant ones and matched them and looked for basically common faces and multiple views and things like that. And that's some of the stuff you see right now. There was a good set which was put up on by the Kramer show. This was even on forums, you know. This guy Kramer, an America radio host, in his forums, they basically took and presented some of this stuff in thousands of forums. And then Infowars.com and other major alternative media websites got a hold of that digested material and just did fine-tuning on top of that to sort of look at it with another set of eyes. And we did the same, and Before It's News and many other forums did the same. And that got narrowed down the story a little bit so that people could follow it. To the point where, right now, so many people are familiar with so many details that aren't even involved in the investigation, more so, I would say, than some of the investigators involved in the case.
Yeah. So what about the Tsarnaevs here and them being possibly framed and everything else? We have this interesting testimony from the father, Ansor Tsarnaev, who basically says that... you know, he believes that the Secret Service actually framed, you know, his sons. What do you make of that testimony?
What it looks like to me is that the older brother, I believe the younger brother is probably innocent. He's probably going off on a daily thing with the older brother. They were probably at the Boston Marathons. What's possible is that, you know, a lot of times if you're a paid informant for the FBI, you get money, you get cash. They give you cars, they give you things in exchange for you basically participating in either informing about Islamic activity at a local mosque or also about any potential radicals and so forth. Because basically if you work in the FBI, you need to bring things to your boss. So this is sort of daisy chain from the director all the way down to sort of street level. And they need to produce results to secure their funding. So what's happened in America is the FBI has become almost addicted to gaining intelligence through these so-called informants, and the police do the same. And a lot of times, there's people who are maybe a young radical, and they're being handled and directed without even knowing it. And so this Tsarnaev, older brother, could have had younger people below him that he was influencing, and he had an FBI handler. And they didn't know he had an FBI handler. It's sort of, that's the kind of daisy chain we saw in London with Abu Hamza and some of these other sort of high-level intelligence informants. And in America, these Sheikh KSM, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, you have all these range of people who have ties with the FBI or with the intelligence agencies. Okay, and a lot of it's just purely a money-motivated thing. Now, what happens is they could be placed in a scene without knowing it, or be told to take part in a drill without knowing what was going to happen. And many times these drills go off and nothing happens. But in this case in Boston, something did go off. So the fact that they're placed at the scene, and they were put at the scene by the FBI, possibly, this is what I believe, would set them up to be a patsy, either a first round or a second round patsy. So this it's a very sophisticated kind of web of gray areas and hidden deceit. But this is how the intelligence and counterterrorism and counterintelligence works. It's not black and white.
Multiple layers of people who might or might not know certain things to be involved and to not be involved. What about the whole drills thing when it comes to the Boston Marathon as well? What was happening at the same time by security agencies, FBI, CIA, etc.? What do we know there?
Well, we know for a fact, based on eyewitness testimonies, that there was a drill going on. This was announced on the Boston Globe. They tweeted this, that there would be controlled explosions on the day. There's still the question of the Kennedy Library. There was allegedly a controlled explosion there. This was said to be unconnected to the bombings at the finish line. We have a high presence of bomb squads, sniffer dogs at the start and finish lines of the events, which begs the question, more than any other time in the history of any marathon in the United States, which begs the question, why now? Why Boston? Why such a high presence? Why was there a drill being run on the day? Police are said, eyewitnesses are said to have heard police say, don't worry, there's just a drill going on. That's why the dogs are out here. Those dogs would have picked up any sniff of gunpowder. And that level of trained dogs, if they're actually that type of dog, would be able to pick up these types of bombs they said went off from quite a long distance. Okay?
Yeah.
So people should look at this and see the pure irony here of the Panopticon state, the security police state, the surveillance state, having all of these cameras, all of this police presence, bomb squad, sniffer dogs, and not be able to stop what happened on the day. Well, the reason is because there was a drill. 7/7 was the same thing. The reason they run drills on the day is because not everybody who's running the drill knows that the drill will go live. In fact, a drill could be hijacked by rogue elements within the agency or with outside of the United States who have access to U.S. data and intelligence. Knowing when these drills are going to happen, they could come right in, infiltrate, and set bombs off, and they wouldn't go off because people would say, oh, it's okay, I'm an informant, I'm part of the drill, I even know the password. Okay, that's how the cover is allowed to go down. If there's any chatter, if there's any vigilant citizen that manages to spot something, that will allow police to stand down and allow stand down orders because of a drill. This is the best time if you want to have a bombing or a staged terror event to blame it on somebody else is to do it when a drill is live. And I believe that's what happened in 9/11. That's what happened in 7/7. This is what happened in Boston.
Is there any evidence or proof at this point that Tsarnaev actually was on the payroll of any of these of the security agencies or CIA, FBI, something like that? What do you know?
I haven't seen any evidence about the payroll, but I do have plenty of evidence, which was provided by interviews with Russia Today and also admissions by the FBI, which they're forced to admit. Now imagine this, the FBI denied having any knowledge or contact with the older Tsarnaev brother before the Boston bombing. And it took Russian media to conduct an interview with the family to get the FBI to have to give up the fact that they had interfacing with this gentleman for years before the event. Now, if they had interfacing with him, then it's likely, in my view anyway, that he would have had a handler. In other words, someone who he was familiar with, who would be his contact, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They could get him to do anything. They could get him to say, okay, what they did, like, for instance, 7/7 is a good example. These were likely British Muslims who wanted to do something good for their country, were approached by the security services saying, you really want to help Muslim Anglo relations, please take part in this drill, we'll train you and pay you as well. And they went along for the ride, and lo and behold, that drill went live. This could have, same thing could have happened in Boston. Now, we do know for a fact, just this link alone between the FBI and this guy that they denied shows that there's a cover-up. And there's also a few red herrings in there. One of them is the presence of a Saudi national, who was also a prime suspect immediately after the event, was taken off, put in protective custody in a hospital, and who allegedly has links to Al-Qaeda. Now, that's not a coincidence. But we also saw the Saudi terrorist being protected and flown out of the country. That exact same story was used in 9/11 to provide cover and confusion. So we also have to remember there are warring factions within the U.S. government. The conservatives would like to seize power again in the U.S. from the Democrats, and by setting up, they could easily set up the president, who is also complicit, who probably has knowledge of a lot of things that are basically criminal activity. So everyone who sits in the White House, every administration is complicit, just purely by their knowledge of things that have gone on previously and things that are going on presently. And everyone's vulnerable, whether they be Republicans or Democrats. They're vulnerable to step in that trap. So I'm only speculating that there is a power struggle right now. That this something could come out of Boston that could unseat, like Benghazi, Benghazi Gate in Libya, that could help to either destabilize an administration or perhaps unseat it in the next election. So these games do go on between the two sort of warring factions on the upper sort of political elite. But at the end of the day, I think that's it's more of a distraction. The big thing that people in the mainstream media do not want to admit or even approach is that there are staged terror events and that the FBI is involved in this. And what is the result of it? The result of it is policy can be implemented. Martial law was implemented in Boston overnight, and people had search and seizures of their home, finding people told to stay in their house, and people just sat and they took it. They took it because they had no choice, and they believed that they were in danger. So this is a great victory for the police state. This is going to secure budgets for Department of Homeland Security, for TSA. This is going to extend the jurisdiction into every major sporting event, college, professional sports, public gatherings, music concerts, festivals, any gathering of people in the United States will have to have their presence there. That is a multi-billion dollar blank check that has just been laid on the table because of Boston. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's where I'm looking, as far as I'm looking at who are the beneficiaries of such an event. So therefore, that will help me by knowing who benefits. I can then look and deconstruct back to see who might have been the person who had the motivation to carry out the crime. Okay? And I see the same theme over and over. I've seen it with regards to especially the Department of Homeland Security. And I'll get into this later. I believe Korea, the standoff between the West and North Korea is a ruse. And it came at the exact time that sequestration budgets were coming in and cutting expenditure budgets, and the military budget had to be presented 2 weeks after that crisis with Korea. And of course, with all the budget cuts in America, the military budget was untouched.
Yeah.
I believe it was because of Korea. Korea is no threat to the United States. North Korea is. And I don't believe it's any genuine threat to any of its neighbors. I think it's a puppet regime, and it's partially propped up by probably elements within the United States establishment, because it provides a nice little bulkhead right in the Far East between China and Japan. And itself, North Korea, just the presence of North Korea over the last 60 years has provided jobs, contracts for some of the biggest companies on the planet, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin. The military-industrial complex has been a beneficiary of that situation in Korea. Likewise, the situation in Israel will never be resolved under the current paradigm, because in itself that is a 24-hour, 365-day-a-week security state in Israel, and there are beneficiaries to that. If there was peace in the Middle East, there would be a lot of arms that would not be able to be sold. And I've also looked this week at a $10 billion arms deal was signed between Saudi Arabia, United States, Israel, and the Emirates.
Mm.
Okay. Now, that's significant. It's significant because the arms industry, you might say, oh, there's only $10 billion. Well, add that $10 billion to the other sort of $5 billion from last year and the other $20 billion for next year, and you keep adding it up, and all the ancillary supplies and ancillary costs and support staff and crew, it's all going to come along with that ticket. This is a giant business, and it exists purely because of the threat of conflict. In the case of the Middle East, it's the Iranian threat, okay? The Iranian threat is stoking the arms industry and the buildup, which is happening in the Gulf states and in Israel, okay? And so I believe that there's manipulation going on. It's almost like the marionette puppet strings are being pulled on all sides.
Yeah.
And who are the beneficiaries? Well, it's very clear who they are. They would not want their...
Sorry, Patrick, let me just ask you this. Do you think, how much of the geopolitical game do you think is sincere, honest? I mean, if we talk about someone like Ahmadinejad, you know, he... Do you believe that he's been placed there to kind of fulfill the role of the boogeyman, and this is to ramp up the conflict or the need for the security that you just mentioned, which is what is increasing ultimately, you know, costs for military, the weapons trade continues, etc. Or is he genuinely he got elected, he's trying to, you know, do his bit, if you will, to try to stabilize the situation in his own way, or is he there to kind of spur it on further? What do you make of it?
I think Ahmadinejad is a product of the situation, and if you want to really look at the cause and the history of that situation, you have to go back to the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in exile in France and was flown in as the Shah was kicked out of Iran. This was the U.S.-backed Shah was kicked off, and I believe that there are elements of the, you know, sort of Jimmy Carter, Henry Kissinger, that sort of trilateral, Zbigniew Brzezinski. These are the architects of the geopolitical shape of Central Asia and the Middle East during that time.
Mm-hmm.
They put Khomeini into power to basically usher in a new paradigm that would provide a 30-year buildup of a military buildup on both sides. Now, it just so happens Iran is also wanting to produce its own nuclear power independently and have its own nuclear medical isotope industry, which is hugely profitable, by the way. There's only two countries in the world that can do that at the moment. There's Canada and Iran. Okay? And so Ahmadinejad, he will be supported by his people because of the external threat which is being placed and the sanctions which are being placed, the punitive collective sanctions being put on Iran. So it serves, you know, he just falls into place. He's a square peg falling into a square hole
in that situation.
Yeah. Now, there is a more sophisticated dimension when you're talking about the Middle East and Iran, and that's the religious dimension, okay?
Sure.
Now, you have to be very careful, at least I do, not to easily conflate the religion with the geopolitics and with the bigger economic chessboard, okay? And the big economic chessboard is about energy. And the most important commodity right now on the planet in terms of regional geopolitics is gas, natural gas, okay?
Yeah.
Oil remains number one on a global scale because oil can be transported long distances, and it can be sourced out in different places. But the gas is something that's specifically needed by people in the northern hemisphere because people need to heat their homes. So being able to supply gas will give you regional dominance or sub-regional dominance. So that's why Qatar, a very small Gulf state, has managed to wield so much leverage and to be so prominent in terms of politics and intervening and basically playing ball with NATO, the UK, and the United States with regards to, you know, funding rebels in Syria, funding the overthrow of Gaddafi, providing troops in Libya on the ground even. And because of so Qatar is able to supply gas to Europe. And there's a competition between Russia and the Gulf states as to who will be the main provider of gas in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years to the European market, okay? So that is a real situation. And there's many pipeline projects, some of which would go via Syria. Turkey is also a big player in this. So you add the religious dimension. The Ahmadinejad is an Assyr Turk in Iran. So you have the two different branches of this sort of Iranian ethnic groups, and Ahmadinejad's ancestors would be coming from Turkey, okay? So it has clans and tribal affiliations and ethnic affiliations with his people. And there's other Persian, Pashtun, and other people in Iran. And so the West and the British identified these clan, these tribal divisions years ago when they were colonizing these regions. And the British were masterful at basically what we know now as divide and rule.
Yeah, playing one against the other and using it to their advantage. Yeah.
Yes, and so they'd often put a minority group in power and support them with money and also provide a protection for them. So the British had the protectorate system. So they would go to a country like Qatar, which was a small emirate, just a peninsula jetting out into the Persian Gulf, and saying, hey, we'll protect you from the Iranians. We'll protect you from the clans in Saudi if you allow us to have a base here and you allow us to sort of, kind of organize your legal system and your economy and everything like that. And you basically provide a British outpost in that region. And so now it's gone a step further. Now Qatar is able to pay the U.S. to have a permanent base in Qatar. So that's real an international protection racket. So it's amazing. If you step back and look at this from a bird's eye view, the U.S. are pressuring Iran, punishing Iran, threatening it with a preemptive strike because it wants to go its own way economically. And so Iran is being able to become more hardened and more radical. And, of course, the people will support a nuclear program just out of nationalist sovereign reasons and also support Ahmadinejad. And so he's more vociferous in his rhetoric towards Israel, towards the West. And meanwhile, the U.S. is laughing and Britain is laughing because they're just flying in, selling arms from BAE Systems to all the Gulf states. And the U.S. has got their contracts with Saudi, upgrading their missile systems, the jets, F-22 Ospreys, long-range fueling for the Israelis. They're just kind of sitting back and laughing because they've managed to play both sides of this paradigm. It is the Anglo-American empire, in my opinion, and not the U.S. It's Britain and the U.S. are hand-in-hand in this sort of domination. Of course, you have NATO as well, which functions as a world army. That's more on the kind of collectivist kind of global government prelude. But behind all this, we do have the City of London. We have, Wall Street. These are the real powers. They are the ones who pay for the political careers, the politicians who go and do what they do internationally. And Syria is another example. They're playing Turkey. They're dragging Turkey in here by exploiting the Turkish aspirations for their version of a secular Islam. And again, people can exploit Iranians' aspirations for the vision of a Persian empire and also exploit the Saudi aspirations for their vision of a Wahhabist, Sunni-based Islamic caliphate. And everyone has their different interests, and the West are masterful at going in, the Anglo-Americans, seeing where the cracks are, seeing where the dividing lines are, exploiting those. That's how they got Qaddafi out. They managed to find cracks in his administration. They went in with offers of money, promises of power after his overthrow. They did the same thing with the Al-Qaeda groups in Libya. They promised them a seat at the table. And, of course, all these things didn't actually happen as planned afterwards. But this is how they look for cracks. They look for divisions. They exploit them. They do it with money, promises of power, control over industries after the dust settles. They're doing this in Syria right now. Okay, they're using Saudi and Qatari assets, Al-Qaeda assets, to destabilize Syria. They're providing arms via Jordan. They're trying to get Turkey to participate in this some way. And what it does is it creates real destabilization so that at the end, at the final analysis, because the region is so destabilized and people actually do dislike each other and are actually killing each other, then there's a real threat of full military destabilization. And that's when you have NATO come in. That's when you have the UN come in. That's when you have America and Britain parachute in. France with, the real powers will come in their in this, you know, exert their influence, exert their power at that point. So it's a cycle. It's a cycle we see over and over again.
And slowly they gain more control of the various regions that they're interested in. We're going to take a break here in a little while, Patrick, but just briefly, then what about specifically in terms of the Middle East, and what about Israel's role in all this running U.S. foreign policy through AIPAC? We have a lot of dual citizens in key positions that are pulling the strings and obviously also using the U.S. military force and their partnership with the U.K. and other countries to work in their favor, correct?
Yes, it is. I mean, first of all, Israel is a great market for the arms industry because by the creation of an Israeli state right in the middle of an Arabic world, when they did this in 1947, they created a permanent state of conflict that would last for 70 or 80 years. We're coming up to the 70th year soon. So Israel is a great outlet. It's a great customer for the arms industry. It gets its money to buy these arms directly from the United States taxpayer. And that's basically a bailout for the military-industrial complex. Military aid is like a bailout. It's basically they give the aid to these countries, and these countries then have to spend that money with U.S. companies or British companies, okay?
Egypt, who was the second largest, giver, or they got the most money after Israel, I think, from the U.S. military, and look at what has happened in Egypt now and what's going on there. It's pretty interesting.
Yes, Egypt is number two recipient of U.S. foreign military aid, and obviously you have the Muslim Brotherhood in power, but you also have the Supreme Armed Forces Command in power, and they're the real power in Egypt. The political power in the Muslim Brotherhood is significant because they don't have control of SCAF, which is the Supreme Command of the Armed Forces. So they are the actual person who's receiving this custom in terms of military aid and allows them to have power. Obviously, this was created again by Israel. Egypt feels the need to be armed up because of its history with Israel and the wars they've had in recent years, in the 70s particularly, okay? So that's already set in motion, that conflict. Then you have the other conflicts with Israel's neighbors. Now, Saudi Arabia and Israel are allies at the highest level, okay? Especially because the U.S. has convinced, through its actions against Iran, mainly, and its sanctions and everything else, and also by putting the Ayatollah in power in Iran, they've guaranteed to have an enemy there for Saudi Arabia and Israel, a ready-made enemy. And that will force, obviously, both of those countries to arm up, and obviously under the auspices of guidance of the United States, of course. But the original issue with regards to Israel was the Palestinian issue, where a lot of Arab countries, and there was a lot of Arab sentiment sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. That's becoming less and less, unfortunately, from a human rights point of view. It's becoming less and less of an issue. The extreme wealth that's being extracted via oil and gas in the Emirates and Qatar and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and that wealth is being spread in Kuwait and some of these countries. This means that those people in those countries, they're not so concerned about the Palestinian issue. In fact, the Palestinians provide them with a lot of cheap labor and cheap management for their industries. The huge migrant worker population, not just from Bangladesh, not just from India, but from Palestine as well and other countries. But those are they're the workhorses of the Arab world. The Palestinians, you find them in every major company, in every major position, specifically in manufacturing and logistics and operational and labor. But so it suits the Arab world to keep the situation as it is. It's like in America. America doesn't want to build up the Mexican economy because it suits the American industries to have cheap labor coming from Mexico. Until that idea changes, that situation will remain the same.
Definitely. Now, there's a lot more points, obviously, here to follow up on, a lot more questions, and we'll try to get to all of it in the second hour, if we can. We're going to return to a few more points on Boston as well. There's a lot of question marks there. But, Patrick, before we take a break here, please give us your website so our listeners know where to go to follow you more on a regular basis. And also, by the way, tell us about the film you have upcoming, if you want to as well.
Yes, my website is 21stcenturywire.com. That's 21stcenturywire, 21stcenturywire.com. And we've got a film project which we started in Cyprus, which is going to document the sort of collapse of Southern Europe, country by country. And I hope to continue that with the European tour in the summer. We're going to try to get crowdfunding for that and from other places, and try to do it as independently as we can, and at low budget as possible, in order to get it done with a sort of skeleton crew, but do it really well. And I'm very encouraged by what we did in Cyprus, which I'll have released, hopefully in May. It's taken a little bit longer because of the Boston situation. I've thrown all my resources and all our volunteers are working on that at the moment. But we've got some exciting film projects coming up, definitely.
Very good. 21stcenturywire.com will be linked up from redeyesoperations.com as well. Well, thank you, Patrick, for the first segment here. Stay with us. We'll carry on with more in just a little bit. We'll be right back.
Baby gone down.
runs the system? What keeps it going? What is the game plan and what are the tactics used? We talk about these questions and many more in the second hour with Patrick Henningsen. The Nordic model, government, regulated media, corporate, communism. It's all in the cards, and we'll discuss some of the tactics that is currently being used to bring this to a country near you. Don't miss the second hour. Go to redicemembers.com and sign up if you haven't already. Get full access to one of the most diverse programs on the internet. Tons of different topics that we find both interesting and important to learn more about. We'll be back with the Radio 314 next. John Rappaport on the art of manipulation, the media matrix of imagination, and how the individual creative artist can defeat the system. You'll find more of our upcoming guests in our radio archive. We'll be back in just a few days, but right now we'll proceed with Patrick Henningsen with a very important continuation. So join us in the members area.